Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Little Georgie Learns to Drink right after this. You know, 3,300 years ago, Moses instructed our fathers. He said, "You shall not have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small. You shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small, but you shall have a perfect and a just weight. A perfect and a just measure shall you have." Now, you know, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 followed that scriptural principle of law. When they put into our Constitution at Article 1, Section 10, these 17 words, it says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debts." But in 1933, President Roosevelt took our gold away, and in 1964, President Johnson took our silver coin out of circulation. And in place of these just weights and balances, these two presidents introduced our current practice of the first, the second, and the fifth planks of the Communist Manifesto into our monetary system. They gave us Federal Reserve notes in place of gold-backed treasury bills, and they gave us clad coinage in place of silver and gold coins. Now, in the intervening 70 years or so, we Americans have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation until today we're the world's number one debtor nation. Now, who do you think were the better financial planners for our country, Moses and our founding fathers, or Franklin D. Roosevelt and Lyndon Baines Johnson? Now, if you'd like to learn more about hard money and how to use it properly, it's another of the many lessons that we teach in our Mosaic Law School. It's conducted twice a year here at the law school. And if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package. That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number's 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the Mosaic Law School is also available on compact disc for adult home study, and if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget. The other day, I read an article in the Reader's Digest about binge drinking, and it was a heart-rending story about a young boy who was being initiated into a fraternity, and as a part of the festivities, I wouldn't say it was a part of the initiation, but it was a part of the festivities, that they had some alcohol there. Now, this boy was about, I think he was 19 years old, a freshman in college, just a young kid. And he drank one whole bottle, that's a fifth, four-fifths of a quart of alcohol. Now, I don't know what kind it was. I don't know if he's drinking vodka or tequila or whiskey or whatever it was, but he did it in a short period of time. It's called binge drinking, as opposed to the average Joe six-pack, you know, that goes out and gets drunk down at, you know, the O'Leary's bar, where you're drinking, you know, for 4 or 5 hours, and pretty soon, you know, you're just passed out drunk under the table, and your buddies have to pick you up and carry you home. This guy just sat down and started drinking. You know, I mean, he's trying to drink this whole bottle of alcohol in the shortest period of time possible. And he did, and he drank it all, and then, of course, he passed out drunk, and then, of course, his buddies say, "Oh, Tom here, he's passed out drunk. We'll just leave him here on the couch, and he'll wake up, and you know, everything will be fine tomorrow. He'll have a hangover, but that'll go away. But the boy didn't come out of it. He died right there on the couch. And then, you know, as the story goes, you know, the college administrators and the teachers, you know, they lament the death of these students. And then the parents are called, and the parents, you know, they get upset about it. And then they want to, you know, they want to start a foundation or a fund to alert and to educate. They want, you know, these parents now, they wanted to start a foundation or a fund to educate you and me and everybody else to the dangers of binge drinking. And when I read the story, I got to thinking, I said, well, where were these parents when this boy was 12, 13, 14 years old? Weren't they educating him about drinking? Didn't these parents tell this boy when he was 12, 13 years old that alcohol taken in excessive quantities is a poison that will kill you? I don't know. I was educated to that fact at age 12. In fact, I think I knew that before age 12, but I came from a family of drinkers. In fact, I don't know of anybody in my family that didn't drink. They didn't drink very much wine. They weren't opposed to drinking wine, but they drank beer and they drank whiskey. A couple of them drank gin. My Uncle Carol, he was a gin drinker. And he didn't drink gin and martinis either. He drank it right out of the bottle. You know, I can remember that just like it was yesterday. Now, my Uncle Carol was an alcoholic. He couldn't control alcohol. I would imagine he was educated in alcohol. My granddad was a drinker, and I'm assuming that he was educated, but then I don't know. That's the point that I wanted to make. I was educated in drinking at age 12. I'll tell you the story here, and then we'll go from there. I was about 12 years old, and one day my dad, just right out of the blue, he said, come on to the kitchen, son, let's have a drink. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know quite what he had in mind, but he was he had a bottle of Four Roses whiskey there on the table, and he had some 7-Up and Coca-Cola, and he said, let's mix up a highball, and I'm going to give you a little education here on drinking. And I thought, wow, that's kind of neat. Here's my old dad. You know, say, hey, son, come on over. Let's have a drink. After I grew up, you know, my dad and I used to go down to the Blue Room or over to O'Leary's or the, you know, the Friendly Corner or someplace, you know, and we'd tip a couple. But when you're 12 years old, that's kind of a wild new experience. And I know some of you sitting out there going, oh, my God, that's child abuse. Oh, no. No, it's part of your education. My dad also instructed me in sex. I didn't learn about sex from my friends and neighbors, and I didn't learn about it in public school. My dad instructed me. I learned a lot by what we call revelation. There's two ways to learn. Now, all of us have just two ways to learn. You're either going to experiment and experience. That's the school of hard knocks. Or somebody's going to tell you. They're going to reveal it to you. That's part of the education process. And then you're going to know. But my dad explained it this way. He said, son, when somebody reveals something to you, it's not nearly as good as your own personal experience. And you won't remember it as well. But, you know, if you experience it, you'll never forget it. It's like reinventing the wheel, you know. If you go out and get drunk and you have this god-awful hangover the next day, that's a better educational tool than for me to tell you that if you drink too much alcohol, then the next day you're going to have this god-awful headache and you're going to feel real bad. The experience, there's just nothing like it. And I don't deny that. But my dad went on to say, he said, it's a god-awful hard way to learn. I mean, we try to teach our children driving without having a head-on wreck at 90 miles an hour. And we try to explain to them by revelation that when when a body falls off of a building, it reaches terminal velocity at 32 feet a second, and then it stops suddenly at the bottom and kills you. That's why we wear parachutes when we jump out of airplanes. And that's because of that sudden stop at the bottom of the fall. The fall doesn't kill you, but it's the sudden stop at the bottom. Well, by the time you've experienced that sudden stop at the bottom, you're dead. And so now you've learned, but it's of no value to you because you're dead. So there's some things in life we need to learn from revelation. Revelation. And the Bible is a book of revelation. It's the book where God comes along and says, let me give you some vital information here about sex and reproduction. Thou shalt not commit adultery. That's a very important lesson to learn. Most people don't receive that lesson through revelation. They receive it through experience. And then from that experience, we have AIDS, herpes, and VD, which isn't a very good outcome to the sexual experience. It isn't the sex that's bad, it's the wrong use of it. Sex is a hell of a neat invention. When God designed sex, I've often said, you know, if God made anything better than a woman, he kept it for himself. So sex was a hell of a neat invention. But AIDS, which comes from sex, isn't such a good outcome to the good experience that you get from sex. Now, driving automobiles is a lot of fun. I've always enjoyed driving, and it's an experience that I think everybody that drives likes. We keep doing it over and over again. It's kind of like sex, you know. You keep doing it over and over again. You never get enough of it. You know, you can have sex 15 times, and you still want to have it 16, 18, and 20. I mean, you can drive your car 10,000 miles until you're just tired and fagged out, and you can hardly drive another mile, and you go in, you sleep all night, you get up in the morning, and God, you're ready to go, and you just want to get out there and drive some more. You never get enough driving, you never get enough sex. And some people never get enough booze. My Uncle Carol was like that. He couldn't get enough wine. He drank a gallon of wine a day toward the end. I say toward the end because, you know, when you get to the point where you're drinking a gallon of wine a day, hell, most of you people couldn't drink a gallon of water a day. You know, if you want to test yourself on, you know, how much liquid can your body absorb, just try drinking 1 gallon of water in a day. You can do it, but boy, I'm telling you, you're going to have a hell of a problem there. I mean, it's a struggle to get a gallon. My Uncle Carol, he could drink a gallon of wine and run out by 4 o'clock in the afternoon and need more. I was absolutely amazed. And you'd think you'd think a guy drinking a gallon of wine would be passed out drunk under the table. Oh, no, 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 no. See, alcohol is a poison, and you can develop a tolerance for a poison. And your body can take that poison in and deal with it. I knew a guy named Darwin. And old Darwin, he was an alcoholic. He wasn't a binge drinker. He just a steady drinker. And you go out to dinner, you know, after we'd finished with the sale, you know, we'd all go out to dinner and have a few, tip a few. And so about 9 o'clock, we'd go into the restaurant and we'd sit there. And, you know, of course, you got to have a round of drinks, and then you have a second round of drinks, and then you eat dinner. And then we get through dinner, you know, we'd drink until the bar closed, 2 o'clock in the morning. And so Darwin would drink, and I used to count these. This guy was a real drinker. He could drink 16 highballs. About 16 ounces of heavy-duty booze. That'd be whiskey. He was a whiskey drinker, although he could drink vodka or tequila or anything else. But he's a whiskey drinker. He drank 16 highballs between 9 o'clock and 2 o'clock in the morning. That's 5 hours. 5 hours. Then go out and get in the car and drive home. And I'm telling you, I would prefer driving home with Darwin drunk than a lot of people sober. I mean, that guy was good. If I drank 16 ounces, I think I might die from alcohol poisoning. I'm not sure I could get 16. I couldn't drink 16 highballs. I couldn't get them down. And I'd be passed out drunk under the table. But see, Darwin had been drinking for so many years. And he was used to that alcohol. He just drank anybody under the table. I never saw anybody that could drink like Darwin. Jensen could. So Just to kind of point that out. Now, there's another little part to the story here. You know, there's people that have tested this. And there was a guy down in Florida. He was a snake venom milker. He'd milk snakes and get the venom out, you know, for medicine and things like that. And so he thought, well, one day one of these cobras is going to bite me, and there's no way that you can treat this. And so he thought, I wonder if I could develop a resistance to this. Kind of like vaccination, you know. You stick a little of this virus or this little bacteria into you, and then you get your immune system triggered, you know, to recognize that. And then when you are exposed to that, then your immune system jumps right in there and it protects you. So he thought, well, I wonder if poison would work the same way. It does. It does. And he injected himself with cobra poison over a long period of time. Sure enough, one day he got bit by one of those cobras and with no ill effects. His body had developed a resistance to the cobra poison. And then, of course, since then, you know, other people have done the same thing. Of course, the first guy that does that, you know, he's looked upon as being a real pioneer. And then other people do that, and well, now it's pretty common knowledge. Well, alcohol is a poison. It's also a food. I don't know if you knew that or not. In the Bible has a lot to say about alcohol. It has a lot to say about sex. A lot of information about sex. A lot of information about alcohol. And this thing of drinking and alcoholism and the whole alcohol subject and binge drinking and the final analysis comes down to religion. It's religion, at least here in the United States. Religion here in the United States governs the discussion on alcohol and alcohol consumption. And we Americans view alcohol and alcoholic consumptions from a religious viewpoint. And we don't discuss temperance with alcohol here in the United States. Temperance is not the subject. Abolition is the subject. Every single time, without exception. Now, back before Prohibition, we had a discussion in the country here, and it was called temperance, and it was called the Ladies' Temperance League. And they were opposed to alcohol, and they wanted a constitutional amendment to ban alcohol and alcoholic sales in the United States. And they pointed out all of the evils that go along with alcohol. Men would go out and drink up their paycheck, and then their families would be hungry. It's kind of like gambling, you know. Some guys, they go out and they gamble away their paycheck, and their families go hungry. Or they go out and drink up their paycheck and their families go hungry. So they pointed that out. No doubt about it, that's an evil. That's a side effect that comes from drinking and gambling, and that's bad. And that's certainly something that needs to be considered. Then they talk about cirrhosis of the liver and people becoming alcoholics. And alcoholism is bad. And cirrhosis of the liver is bad. I remember Mickey Mantle, remember the famous baseball player? The thing that made him so famous just before he died was that he had a liver transplant because he drank a lot. You know, and your liver has to detoxify your body. So if you drink a lot of alcohol, it taxes your liver, and pretty soon you get cirrhosis of the liver, and pretty soon you die from it. Well, he got a liver transplant and then died. He probably lived an extra 6 months or a year with the liver transplant and then died. I don't know if the operation was a success or not, but he ended up dying from it. Well, anyway, the temperance people got into the thing over here, and they persuaded Americans that and especially the legislatures and the Congress of the United States, that this alcohol was a bad, bad product and a bad idea, and that we needed to abolish it. And so we did. We passed a law here, a constitutional amendment, and we abolished booze from about 1920 to about 1935, about 15 years there. We had an experiment. Now, the truth of the matter is the people called the Ladies' Temperance League was never at any time interested in temperance. Temperance means the moderate use of. It means the controlled use of. These people were not temperate. These people were abolitionists. Their goal, their motivation in life was to abolish alcohol. Not to educate people to use alcohol in moderation, to use it intentionally or intelligently. That wasn't their goal. And they succeeded, and they abolished it altogether. Now, when you try to abolish something, there's something in people. I don't know what it is exactly, but there's something in people. You tell them you can't do it, and by God, they're going to go do it. So instead of telling people, don't do that, and we're going to take it away from them, well, just take drugs. You know, the government comes along, and they've abolished cocaine. Now, cocaine comes from a cocoa plant. And this cocoa plant is, it's a pretty popular plant. We make Coca-Cola from it, and we make cocaine from it, and we make, I think it's chocolate also comes from it. And it's a useful plant. And the natives down in South America, they chew on the leaves, and they eat them, and they seem to get along with it all right. Now, in our country, we've abolished the manufacture and sale and use of cocaine. Well, at least that's the law. Now, we use the stuff all the time. See, even medical doctors use it. I have a student who's a druggist, and every once in a while we have a conversation, and I ask him one day, I say, how about marijuana, cocaine, and heroin? He says, oh, yeah, those are pharmaceuticals, and we sell them every day. But we don't call cocaine cocaine. He told me what the name was, the pharmaceutical name. We don't call marijuana marijuana. We have a pharmaceutical name for it. And we don't call heroin. We call it by its pharmaceutical name, morphine. And they sell that stuff. You just walk in and ask your doctor for it, and he'll give it to you. They charge six times more than you can buy it for down on the street. But it's the same stuff, comes from the same plant, same pharmaceutical. Now, the reason there's an illegal or illicit drug trade is because the illegal drug salesmen, the sellers, you know, the crack cocaine guys, they sell it for about 1/6 of what you buy it for at Osco Buttery or Rexall, you know. But that's not to say it's not available. The controversy in drugs isn't over drugs. Everybody is in favor of drugs. Everybody wants drugs. The controversy is over the turf. It's over who are you going to buy it from. And so the government and the pharmaceutical industry, they want to use the police power of government to force you to buy the drugs that you want, that you desire, from Rexall. They do not want you to buy those drugs from Joe down on the corner, even though Joe can sell them at 1/6 the price that you're paying for the doctor and the pharmaceuticals. And Joe down on the corner, he wants you to buy from him because it is so profitable, even though he's only getting 1/6 as much as you have to pay for a prescription down at the drugstore. He's making god-awful profit margin on it because the stuff is so cheap to make. So drugs are extremely profitable, and everybody loves drugs, as is evidenced by the fact, especially older people love drugs, because when you get to be 65, 70 years old, you know, an old fart like me, the average person, 65 years old, here in the United States, the average guy 65 years old or older is on 6 prescription medications. So, listen, drugs among us old people are extremely popular. And then everybody else in society takes drugs. Well, I say everybody, you know, there's probably a couple, 3 guys out there that don't, but they're definitely in the minority. So I just wanted to point out to you that drugs are extremely popular, and the controversy isn't over doing away with drugs. You know, I said, just say no, just say no. No, wait a minute. Hang on a second. The conversation isn't over just say no to drugs. The conversation is about just say no to illegal drugs. We want you to pay 6 times more down at Rexall. It's okay to take cocaine, but make sure that you get good, clean cocaine from your doctor's prescription and Pfizer and Merck down at the Rexall drugstore. All right, now, The conversation on alcohol is exactly the same. We're not sitting here talking about drinking in moderation or using alcohol intelligently. We're talking about eliminating alcohol. We want to do away with it. But you see, alcohol is so popular. Everybody likes it. Everybody wants it. And what is it about it? It tastes awful. Oh, my God. When I was 12 years old, my dad poured me a highball, and I started drinking. Oh, that whiskey was just, first of all, he poured whiskey on the rocks. He said, I want you to taste whiskey so that you can see what it tastes like. And, you know, so here I'm 12 years old, and I take a little sip of this whiskey on the rocks. Whiskey just tastes gross. And then my dad said, well, it's an acquired taste. Acquired taste. Listen, I didn't need any acquired taste to learn how to eat honey or Hershey bars or drink Coca-Cola. There isn't any acquired taste to Coca-Cola Hershey bars. Come on, let's wake up and smell the coffee. It tastes good. God, we love it. So, you know, my dad, he said, well, now what we do to get rid of that harsh taste of the alcohol, in other words, to camouflage the flavor, it's like using spices on rotten meat. You know, who in hell wants to eat rotten meat? So, the reason that the Indians and South Americans who live in the tropics use so much spice on their meat, it's because before we had refrigeration, meat spoils pretty rapidly. So when you got rotten meat and it smells bad and it tastes bad, you put a lot of spices on it to kill the taste, to kill the flavor of the rotten meat. That's the purpose for having spices. Hell, the spices are probably as bad as or almost as bad as the rotten meat. Well, we do the same thing with alcohol. I mean, the alcohol tastes so bad that we have to put Coca-Cola with it to make a Coke High or to make a 7-Up highball or, you know, to make a screwdriver. You know, we mix an ounce of vodka with a glass of orange juice. Now, everybody likes orange juice, Coca-Cola, and 7-Up. Nobody likes whiskey, vodka, tequila. God, the stuff is so gross that you can't hardly get it down. And so we mix it up with these other good-tasting things, and then we can get... And what we're really after isn't the taste, it's the effect. It's the effect. You see, we like the effect of smoking. We like the effect of alcohol. So that's why we're drinking. And after you've had that effect, you know, it's kind of like sex. You say, wow, that was really pretty good. Felt real good. And so I like that, and so I want to do that again. You know, it's like riding the roller coaster. If you don't puke your guts out, you know, when you take your first roller coaster ride, if you can keep it all down, that was quite an experience. That's why people want to jump out of airplanes with parachutes and ride roller coasters and things, because of the effect. It's the weightlessness. It's the G-load at the bottom of the roller coaster, and the weightlessness as you go over the top, and the loop, you know, and it's kind of like flying airplanes, you know. You like the effect of the ride in the airplane, you like the effect of the ride in the car. And so human beings like these various effects, these experiences, and alcohol has an experience. It has an effect, and we like it. And so it's very popular. Now, at the same time, if you drink too much, too often, you can develop a dependence upon it. I mean, you can actually become addicted to alcohol. You can become addicted to cocaine, marijuana, and so on. You can get addicted to sex. I always thought sex was pretty good. And I haven't given it up yet. As old as I am, I haven't given up on sex. And I hope I don't until I'm 110. And even then, I'd like to keep on until I'm about 120. You know, when something's good, you kind of like to do it again and again and again and again. Alcohol is good, and if it's used in moderation. But see, the conversation has never been about moderation. It's been about abstinence. Now, I remember a guy named Kent Hovind, hell of a nice guy, great, great teacher and educator. He's a Baptist, and he made a comment one time on one of his tapes dealing with evolution. This isn't an evolutionary statement, but it's a statement that a Baptist would make from time to time. He says, alcohol has never touched my lips. Alcohol has never touched my lips. He's not the first guy that has ever said that. I heard that years and years ago, and I suspect that it was probably Billy Graham or some famous evangelist, you know, some righteous guy, that could make that claim. I can't do that. See, alcohol has touched my lips. I am a fallen man. It's kind of like a virgin, you know, is a fallen woman. She's had sex before she was married. She's a fallen woman. That's what they call it. My granny used to tell me about whores. You know, those are ladies of the night. Those are fallen women. Well, okay. Everybody has this famous little statements or famous little cliches that they make. Well, you know, liquor, alcohol has never touched my lips. I thought about that and I said, you know, Kent Hovind could never teach his children how to drink like my dad did. Why is that? How in the hell could Kent Hovind teach his children how to drink? He's never drank himself. Now, he has taught his children about alcohol, but he didn't teach them about responsible drinking. He just taught them abstinence. Well, hell, why don't you teach your children about abstinence from driving automobiles? Why don't you teach your children about abstinence from sex? Why don't you teach your children? I mean, if you're concerned about your child in his overweight condition, why don't you teach him abstinence from food? Now, it is certainly true that when people drink, they run the risk of becoming an alcoholic. Well, don't people who eat run the risk of becoming a glutton? And yet, I've never heard anybody say, let's teach our children to stop eating because there's a danger that they could become a glutton. Don't we try to teach our children to eat responsibly? Well, some people do. I mean, most people, they don't have any objections to potato chips and Ho-Ho's, Ding-Dongs, and Twinkies, and Coca-Cola. But, you know, aside from that, don't you kind of teach your children that once in a while they ought to eat a carrot, you know, or a rutabaga or something? Maybe eat a piece of meat or, you know, if you're not a vegetarian. We try to teach our children responsible driving. And yet, you know, children will go out, young people, and they'll run their car at 90 miles an hour around a 35-mile-an-hour curve, roll it over four times. They get thrown out of the car because they weren't wearing their seat belts, and then the car runs over them or rolls over them and kills them. And then we sit there and start funds to educate people about the dangers of automobiles. My dad also taught me how to drink. He taught me about sex. He taught me about driving. He taught me about booze. By revelation, and told me, impressed it upon me, said, now you can learn about these things by experimentation and experience, but it's a god-awful hard way to learn, son, and you'd be better off if you let me tell you, let me reveal to you about what happens when an automobile is traveling at 60 or 70 miles an hour approaching a 35-mile-an-hour curve. You need to slow down. Hey, let me give you a reminder here at the halfway point that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, they're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, talking about little Georgie learns to drink. So my dad, at the very same time that he was teaching me about vodka and screwdrivers, he gave me a great education in mixing drinks and various drinks. There's highballs and there's martinis and my dad, he could make just about anything. He was a bartender. You know, kind of a part-time bartender. I mean, he wasn't a real professional bartender, but he was a pretty good bartender, and he could mix drinks, and he was pretty familiar with the various alcoholic beverages. He taught me about tequila and tequila with the worm. That's really gross when you look at this grub, you know, in the bottle of tequila. I thought that was pretty sick, but, you know, a grub in the tequila probably isn't anything to worry about. After all, the alcohol is a disinfectant. You're not going to get any germs off of it. It's just kind of the thought of it. It's kind of like eating honey. You know, honey is really vomit. It's puke is what it is. The bee eats food and then makes honey in her stomach, and then she vomits that up and puts it into the cell in the hive. And when you tell people that, they get kind of excited, and they get kind of nauseous. They put on a little show. Oh, my God, that honey is bee vomit. It's kind of like birds, you know. They go out and they eat, and then they come back and regurgitate their food for their baby birds. And so, you know, eating vomit's kind of common. I mean, it's out there, and so humans do it also, but not kind of the same way. And this thing of the worm in the tequila kind of reminded me of that. I try to avoid tequila because of that worm. I guess it's because I've got a weak stomach. Then my dad gave me a final instruction. He said, "Son, anytime you want a drink, you just come on in and help yourself, and you can drink whiskey or vodka, anything that's in the liquor cabinet." But he said, "I don't want you to give any of this, not one single drink, to any of your pimply-faced punk friends. And I don't want you out drinking with your pimply-faced drunk friends. And anytime you want a drink, it's right here in the liquor cabinet, and you can feel free to drink." He also taught me how to smoke. My dad was a smoker also. And he taught me about cigarettes. He said, you know, it wouldn't be bad if you never smoked at all. It'd probably be better for your health. But he said, you are going to smoke. You are going to go out and experiment with cigarettes, pipes, cigars. You're going to experiment with alcohol. And he said, I don't want you to learn about alcohol and drinking from your pimply-faced punk friends. I don't want you to learn about smoking and tobacco from your peers. He said, I want you to learn to be responsible. What a wild concept my old dad had. He said he wanted me to be a responsible driver, a responsible husband and father. He wanted me to be a responsible drinker, a responsible smoker. He said, hell, if you never drank in your life, probably wouldn't hurt you any, but you know, you're going to. Everybody does. And then he told me about this binge drinking at 12 years old, and he explained to me, how much can you drink? That's a question that oftentimes is never answered. How much alcohol should you drink? How much alcohol can you drink? Do you know there's an answer to that? Very logical, straightforward answer. Depends on your body weight. And so you simply calculate your body weight. And then everybody, since not everybody's body metabolizes alcohol the same. Like I told you about Darwin. I mean, that guy's body metabolizes alcohol at a faster rate than normal people. He can dissipate that alcohol faster than ordinary people. And he wasn't fat. He wasn't overweight. He probably weighed 220 pounds, 16 highballs. Now, the correct amount of highballs for the average Joe six-pack in an evening of drinking would be 4 ounces of hard liquor over the course of 4 or 5 hours would be just about the right amount to get the full effect of the alcohol without passing out drunk, being able to keep your faculties about you, to enjoy the benefits of alcohol without suffering from the deleterious effects that come from alcohol poisoning. So, let me give you a little illustration, tell you a little story here. There was a lady who was a lawyer, and she worked for the Department of Labor in the state government of Idaho, and they had a Christmas party, you know, like a lot of people, you know, do at the Christmas time. They got to have a party, and they had a little alcohol there. Now, this lady is small. She's they call her petite, you know. Ordinarily, where I'm from, they call them skinny, undernourished, flat-chested. But anyway, this lady is pretty small. She probably weighs 100, 110, 20 pounds. And she drank, and the records show that she drank 4 highballs, 4 ounces of alcohol. And then she went out and got in her car, and she drove home. Now, while she was driving home, she passed out drunk and ran over 2 little children and killed them. But wait a minute, wait now. It's okay. It's okay. Don't panic now. She had a driver's license. She was fully insured. She had a driver's license, and she was fully insured. So the fact that she ran over these 2 kids, it's okay. She did it legally. Now, you're going to sit there and say, well, see, it was that demon rum that did it. No, it wasn't. See, that woman was never educated in drinking. She did not know how to drink. She did not know how much alcohol she could drink. And she went to the party and she drank. Now, she's a lawyer, and she should have known that driving while you're drunk is against the law. So, okay, but you're not a lawyer, and you're a plumber, a carpenter, a farmer, and you know that driving while you're under the influence is against the law, but you do it anyway. Now, if that woman had been educated in how much to drink, she would have drank 1 or 2 highballs at 110 pounds. Furthermore, is she a drinker, or is she just an occasional drinker, a binge drinker? See, a binge drinker is somebody that doesn't drink all the time. They just go out and drink when they're having a wild party. The man I talked about, Darwin, that guy drank 16 highballs every night. He didn't just drink once in a while. He drank every night, day after day after day. His body is totally accustomed to digesting and metabolizing 16 ounces of alcohol a day. Just like my Uncle Carol, he could digest and metabolize 1 gallon of Gallo Burgundy wine. Drink Gallo Burgundy. Now, the average Joe Sixpack can't do that. So, first thing you need to do here, you need to experiment a little bit. Now, you want to drink for the effect, but you don't want to drink until you're drunk. See, drunk. That's over-drinking. It's kind of like
pigging out, you know. You ever watch people that go to the smorgasbord? And I don't know if all you people around the world know how this works, but here in the United States, we have smorgasbord restaurants. That is self-service restaurant. You walk down this line, and there's all of these trays. Look, kind of like a cafeteria, but they don't serve you. You serve yourself. See, in a cafeteria, they give you a certain portion, and then you get to the end of it, and you pay. In a smorgasbord, you just walk in and pay, and then you pick up a tray, and you walk down the line, and you just take whatever you want. And you can go back as many times as you want. So you can take your food and go sit down at the table. And then if you're still hungry, you can get up and go get another serving or another helping. And you can do that as often as you want. I mean, hell, if you wanted to, you could go back there 5 times, I guess, if you wanted to. I never have, but sometimes I might go back a second time or go get a dessert or something. But have you ever watched fat people at a smorgasbord? Oh, my God. That's an experience. Just if you want to go people watching, you know, just go watch some fat guy at a smorgasbord. I mean, they can get more on a plate than the plate was ever designed to hold. I'm amazed at how much food you can get on one 9-inch plate. I would almost venture to say that they can get 35, 40 pounds on a 9-inch plate. They stack it on, they arrange it in a certain specific way, they mound it up to a point in the middle, and they garnish the sides and the edges of it. In fact, it won't hold everything they put on it, and it's fallen off. It falls off on the floor, it falls off into the other. I mean, they're putting mashed potatoes on their plate, and the gravy is dripping off here into the carrots and peas and stuff. And it's really an art form. How much food can you get on one 9-inch plate? And I really don't understand the purpose behind it because, you know, you can fill your plate up once, half full, so that it doesn't fall off, go eat it, and then come back and get another plate. And then a third, fourth, fifth, and 19th. These people have enough on their plate. For ordinary guys like me, I'd have to go back 5, 6, 7 times to get as much food on my plate as these people do on one plate in one trip. And I don't know if they go back for a second trip or not. Maybe they're so fat they can't go back for a second trip and have to get it all on the first trip. I don't know. But anyway, I just thought I'd throw that one out there for you. Now, this lady over here, she ran over these two children, killed them. And then there was a trial. The insurance company didn't pay these people for their dead babies. And this lady, when it was all said and done, served 1 year with a suspended license, 2 years probation, 1 year suspended license, and 200 hours of community service and a $1,000 fine. Total payment. $1,000 fine. 2 years probation, 1 year suspended driver's license, 200 hours of community service. And the insurance company wouldn't pay until these people sued, and then there was a settlement out of court, and I don't know what the settlement was. Now, there's an example of a woman, a professional, a lawyer. She didn't know how to drink. And maybe she came from a family like Kent Hovind. Alcohol has never touched my lips. And the lady didn't know how to drink. So she learned how to drink at a Christmas party. I don't think a Christmas party is the place to learn to drink. And I don't think that a fraternity is the place to learn how to drink. I don't think binge drinking on frat night or at spring break is the place for you to learn how to drink. And I don't think it's the place for your children to learn how to drink, because If they try to drink a quart of whiskey in one fell swoop, there's every reason to believe that they'll die from alcohol poisoning. Now, fortunately for most of you young people out there, you learn how to drink in college or high school. You learn how to drink from your peers. You don't learn from your parents because they don't drink. They're religious, remember? And they're not temperate, they're abolitionists. Now, boys and girls, you cannot learn from abolitionists. You learn from people that actually do it. For instance, could you learn driving from somebody that doesn't drive? Well, how in the hell can you learn drinking from somebody that doesn't drink? I mean, kind of mull it over a little bit. You know, it just seems kind of logical to me. I learned driving from my daddy, who was a driver. You know, he might not have been the world's greatest. He wasn't an A.J. Foyt, you know, but he could drive the car. And he taught me a lot of neat tricks about driving, and that prevented me from having accidents. He taught me how to drive on snow and ice, explained it to me, why it works that way, how it works. He explained to me how to use the accelerator and the brake when you're going into a turn, when you're coming out of the turn, how not to use the brake, you know, when you're skidding and sliding on ice. Well, all kinds of little things that were revelatory rather than experimentary. So rather than experiment. Now people learn to drink by experimentation. And that's the way this lawyer learned how to drink. She learned by experimenting. She experimented with four highballs, got in the car, drove home, killed two kids. Well, okay, but there was a better way to learn. But her parents more than likely could not teach her to drink because they didn't drink, if they were typical. And colleges don't teach these people how to drink. Colleges are opposed to it. In fact, they're trying to discourage drinking, which is like trying to discourage a drug addict from using drugs. They're going to use drugs. That's the end of the argument. They're going to drink. They're going to smoke. They're going to have sex. They're going to drive cars. Now, we're careful to teach our young people how to drive cars. In fact, we have in this country what we call driver's education in high school. And now, as I understand it, you can't graduate from high school until you first successfully passed your driver's education course. So driving automobiles is more important in this country than learning how to read and write and do your arithmetic. Because you can graduate from high school, and you don't have to read to graduate from high school. You don't have to be able to write to graduate from high school. You don't have to be able to count or do arithmetic to graduate from high school in the United States. But by God, you better know how to drive. Because if you don't drive, you can't drive, you can't graduate. So that's where our priorities are. Now, it would seem like to me that to prevent people, young people, from killing themselves with booze, that we ought to have at least a short course in our high schools that talk about binge drinking and alcohol poisoning, at least to the same degree that we do with automobiles. And if we did that, I think we could probably eliminate a lot of binge drinking deaths if we just educated them to that point. Now, there's another facet to this. We have alcoholism here in the United States, which is a god-awful big problem. If we were to teach these people things like responsible drinking, how much should you drink and how often should you drink? You know, how often? Well, it's kind of like saying, well, how often should you have sex? You know, once a week, twice a week, every day, three times a day. And, you know, there are physical limits, aren't there? Aren't there some physical limits out here to activities? How fast can you drive? Well, kind of depends on the road conditions. You can't just say, well, sex is twice a week and that's the limit, or that 60 miles an hour is the limit. You know, there might be an exception. Maybe you might want to drive 70 or 80. Maybe you might want to drive 45 or 50, or maybe even 15 or 20. So depending upon the conditions, you know, we drive our automobiles depending upon the conditions. Don't you think we should learn how to drink depending upon the conditions? Don't you think we ought to be able to come to a conclusion, make an intelligent decision? Gee, should I be drinking at this juncture of time, since how I got to drive home when I get through? I remember one time I was down at Jake's having dinner, and my old buddy Colton Fryer, he said, George, you better take a cab home. You're too drunk to drive. And that was probably a pretty good observation on his part. the guy that's drunk probably doesn't know how drunk he is, but his friends can see. And so I knew I was drunk, but I didn't know I was that drunk, you know. And so I said, I have $500,000 worth of liability insurance. See, I had a company, and we had several pickups and trucks and a fleet of them, in fact. And so we had a lot of insurance, you know. And I said, I don't think I can cause $500,000 in damage in 16 blocks. I went out and got my pickup and proved I was right again. Drove home. Didn't cause any damage. Again. Was that responsible? I got to tell you that no, that wasn't very responsible, but I wasn't responsible for my actions because I practiced limited liability. The insurance company was responsible, not me. Now, when we talk about responsibility, whose responsibility is it to teach your children about drinking? Well, obviously, it's not the parents, because they don't. In this country, parents do not teach their children how to drink. In fact, they send them off to college, and the college doesn't teach them how to drink, and the high school did not teach them how to drink. All three of these institutions taught them not to drink. They never at any time teach their children how to. Kind of like, if I tell them don't drink, that'll solve the problem. That absolves me from any further responsibility. Then when your kid goes out, drinks, kills himself in the process, we get real, real emotional, and then we want to set up trusts and foundations to warn other people about what happened to our son, what happened to our daughter. Wouldn't you be better served, before your daughter or your son kill themselves with binge drinking, why don't you teach them how to drink? But then most of you people couldn't do that because alcohol has never touched your lips. How in the hell could you teach your children to drink responsibly when you yourself don't know how to drink responsibly? Remember, you're not a drinker at all. You're an abolitionist. Abolitionists do not know how to drink responsibly. Just like people that don't drive do not know how to drive responsibly. And people that don't drive cannot teach driving. So it would seem like to me that if you are a teetotaler and a Baptist and you don't drink and you're an abolitionist, that you should get on the bandwagon and hire an alcoholic for your local high school How to Drink 101 class. That colleges and universities should hire alcoholics. I can't think of better people to teach drinking than alcoholics. I remember my dad, he said, when it's time to teach you about sex, son, I'm going to take you down to the whorehouse. There's nobody better to teach sex than a whore. God, my old dad just filled with wisdom, wasn't he? Now, I can understand that some of you people might have a couple of three ideas, you know, concerning this thing of sex and teaching sex and alcohol, but mull it over until we come back and talk about this next time. Who's a better sex educator? A sodomite in your high school or you at home? Hey, I'm out of time, and I got to give you a reminder here that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. Now, the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives. And all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.